From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, domestic violence in Russia. India builds a new city. And why Jingjing the Olympic panda isn't getting the bamboo she used to. It's one of Russia's most pervasive problems, but one few Russians ever talk about. According to a government estimate, on average, a Russian woman dies at the hands of her husband or partner every hour. Yet the police do nothing. Domestic violence is not even considered a crime. NPR's Moscow correspondent Gregory Pfeiffer reports.
Elena Litvin married a medical student in 1995, expecting to begin a happy family life. She had two children, but says her marriage soon became a nightmare.
My husband began staying out late drinking. He'd come home angry and beat me in front of the children. He'd hit me in sensitive areas such as the stomach and chest, avoiding my face and hands so the marks couldn't be seen in public.
Litvin says her husband threatened to kill her. She was desperate, but too afraid to complain. That's hardly unique in a country where victims of domestic abuse often have nowhere to turn. In Moscow, a city of more than 10 million people, there's not a single shelter for battered women. Even at this shelter outside Moscow, there are only 7 beds. It's one of only 20 government-run shelters in the entire country. Director Marina Nikitina downplays the issue of domestic violence. She says domestic abuse is no worse in Russia than anywhere else. Others disagree. Even the government's own figures estimate 14,000 women die each year from domestic violence. That's about one every hour. It's more than 10 times the number of deaths in the United States, which has twice Russia's population. Experts say there are signs the government is starting to take action against domestic violence. But they say the real number of victims is impossible to count because domestic violence is hidden away, seen as a private matter not to be aired in public. Russian law doesn't recognize domestic violence as a crime. Marina Pisklakova, director of the ANA Center for Domestic Violence, says even authorities willing to intervene in abuse cases often can't act until it's too late.
It's very difficult for them to do their job. They all know that until the injuries are medium, severe, or murder occurs, they cannot intervene.
Pisklakova says that to be classified as a medium case, an injury has to prevent someone from being able to work for 2 weeks. Even women able to prove they're victims of domestic violence often face insurmountable obstacles in a legal system in which restraining orders don't exist. Many women who file complaints against their partners end up retracting them. Elena Litvin finally gathered the courage to go to the authorities, but she says the police initially refused to investigate her claims. It took them 6 months to start criminal proceedings against her husband. Litvin finally divorced him in 2004. But like many estranged Russian couples, they couldn't afford to move apart and continue to live together, which she says is seriously harming their young children.
They tell me it's difficult to bear his presence. He gets drunk and follows us around, finding fault with every word we say. His goal is to humiliate us.
Marina Pisklakova says domestic abuse is common in patriarchal societies such as Russia's, where violence is often justified as a way of controlling women, and where an old saying advises, if he beats you, he loves you.
She must have done something wrong to deserve it. That mentality is still there. The mentality of women being basically created to serve men, that mentality is still there in many ways.
One survey found more than half of women questioned said they'd been beaten by their husbands. Pisklakova says many Russians believe domestic violence to be acceptable in a society that sees itself as emotional and passionate, and where the impetuous Russian soul is invoked to explain away what's seen as violent crimes of passion. Elena Litvin says even though her ex-husband was convicted of attempted murder, he He was sentenced to only 1 year of probation. I have to go back to the same apartment, she says. I have to hear the same threats, and I can't do anything about it. Gregory Pfeiffer, NPR News, Moscow.
The Indian city of Mumbai has just about run out of space. With a population of some 14 million and counting, the city that serves as the commercial and entertainment capital of India is bursting at the seams. But there might be a solution on the horizon, where, as NPR's Philip Reeves reports, they're building a new Mumbai.
Caked in dust and dressed in rags, this boy is just trying to make a living. He's so small, many in the sea of people sweeping past don't notice he's there. An emaciated figure, aged about six, begging at knee level. He works one of the world's toughest beats. It's not that people here don't have money. There are plenty of rich people around. This city's where India's money gets invested, where the business is done. Property prices rival Manhattan or London. But at knee level on the streets, competition's as fierce as it is on the stock exchange. Half of Mumbai lives in slums, and the poor keep on arriving, hundreds every day, lured out of the countryside by the whiff of wealth. The best way to see Mumbai is by train. It's a little dangerous. Some commuter trains are so jammed, passengers just fall out. Hundreds of passengers die every year, but at least the trains move, unlike the traffic on the clogged up roads. The city's bursting at the seams. Just look out of the train window.
There are shacks with people living in them beside the railway tracks. They're washing spread out on the ground. There are blistered apartment blocks crammed full of people, a lot of trash, open drains. You can smell them sometimes.
Mumbai was built by the Arabian Sea on a cluster of small islands that were eventually leveled to make one big island. The city can't grow sideways anymore, only upwards. Pasted on the wall of our train, there's an advertisement. It shows a metropolis lit up like Las Vegas, sprouting out of the landscape. It's called Navi Mumbai. Navi means new. That's where we're going now.
We've left Mumbai now and we're running along the coastline. To my right is the sea and some mangrove swamps. On the other side of the bay, we can now see, rising on the skyline, these high-rise modern buildings, and that's Navi Mumbai, New Mumbai. From here, it looks quite impressive.
Ashok Menon's going there too for a business appointment. He's got a good job in the shipping business and an inherited family home in Mumbai. He says he couldn't afford to buy a house in Mumbai these days.
Someone who wants to have their own property in Mumbai, either they must be very, very rich or they should probably get an inheritance. Otherwise, it's not likely that you could afford a property in Bombay anymore.
New Mumbai is considerably cheaper. We've arrived. We're sitting in what is now a cafe, but was once a mangrove swamp.
The place that we are sitting on right now was total water. So this whole area is all water. It was water. It's now become land and now it's developed.
Frank Gomez lives in Navi Mumbai.
There are malls all over. There are hotels all over. It's quite good.
Gomez is 22. That's only 6 years below the average age here. Work began on creating Navi Mumbai in 1970. The idea was to take pressure off the old city. The new city's entirely planned. For a long time, the project stagnated. But when the economy began to boom, big new companies moved in. They include India's largest private sector company, Reliance, led by the industrial magnate Mukesh Ambani. It's investing vast sums in the city. The new Mumbai has glistening shopping malls where people play indoor cricket. It also has some 2 million inhabitants, including Sushmita Sen.
Do you like it here?
Navi Mumbai? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I just hate Mumbai.
What do you like about it?
The space, so much of space. We are a better city. We are a prettier city.
These are the young men who keep Navi Mumbai pretty. Nitin, Ranjit and Pankaj. For 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, they clean malls. They get $120 a month. 98% of the people of Navi Mumbai are literate. These three have missed out. They can't afford the boutiques and bars. For them, this place is far from utopian. Nor is it utopia for this man.
Utopia, Navi Mumbai. Good Lord. The first step to hell, if you ask me.
Environmentalist Bitu Saigal thinks Navi Mumbai is being built in the wrong place.
I would wager if you spoke to 1,000 people, perhaps one might even know that there is something called climate change, which is an issue. And Navi Mumbai is almost all created at sea level.
Saigal says Navi Mumbai is on land that belonged to indigenous village people.
There were small farmers there, and there was mangroves. Mangroves and corals probably feed 25% of all humanity on Earth.
We may have hacked some mangroves, but then we have a whole new city to talk about.
That's Kishore Rathod. He's news editor at the Navi Mumbai office of the newspaper DNA. For years, he was a beat reporter here. For a long time, he thought the city would fail.
There were no trees, there was no greenery. People used to say it's a malaria-infested place. It was a nightmare.
Rathod's changed his mind. He says Navi Mumbai is adding at least 100,000 people a year.
And these people are earning good money. Now they're earning salaries upwards of 30,000 rupees, 40,000 rupees. Where do they spend that? They need the malls. They need the food courts. They need the multiplexes. They need the theatres.
Apparently, they also need fancy cars.
You have the Hummers flying on the road of Navi Mumbai. You have the Ferraris flying on the road of Navi Mumbai. Now America is going to small cars and we are talking about big cars.
On the horizon, immediately in front of me, there's New Mumbai. But on the spot where I'm actually standing, surrounded by litter, there's a line of little shelters made out of wood and plastic sheeting. And under one of those, Arby Boyer, a fisherman, is treating his boat, made out of mango tree wood, in preparation for another night's fishing in the polluted waters that stand between these two cities, the old Mumbai and the new. Arby Boyer is a Kohli. The Kohlis have fished these waters since way back. Boyer says he's paying the price for India's urban explosion. Some days he catches nothing because the water's so badly polluted. He's more resigned than angry.
What use is anger? No one listens to us poor people.
Getting your voice heard isn't easy. Builders are hard at work. There are plans for an international airport. This year, 5 new malls will open. Rathod, the newspaper man, expects his city to change even more in the next few years.
This place will probably be more populated, probably more congested, probably more noisy, but much more rocking.
Philip Reeves, NPR News.
Coming up, China's Panda Center after the earthquake.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The earthquake in China 2 months ago left almost 90,000 people dead or missing, and many cities, towns, and villages in ruins. The cost of reconstruction in the province of Chengdu will be enormous, and one priority for the Chinese authorities is to restore the region's income from tourism. NPR's Louisa Lim travelled to one of Chengdu's most important tourist attractions, the giant panda breeding centre.
Watch me grow, panda!
A gaggle of 9-year-olds has been practising for this moment. It's the Chinese launch of a book called Watch Me Grow. This tells the story so far of probably the world's most watched 2-year-old, panda Jingjing, who's also an Olympic mascot. Her home is here at the Chengdu research base of giant panda breeding, where the buzz of cicadas vibrates through the bamboo. Joe Lusby, general manager of the publisher Penguin China, says it's donating the book's profits, so far $30,000 from US sales, to the centre.
We really decided to launch it here now to partly highlight the problems that the centre here are having in terms of lost revenue from tourism.
The base hasn't suffered any physical damage, but visitor numbers plummeted, with many tourists cancelling trips to the region after the earthquake. Now just 300 people visit every day, about a tenth of the normal number. The centre predicts it will lose more than $1 million in revenue this year.
Economically, it is a disaster.
Zhang Zhihe, the centre's director, says it's cost-cutting wherever it can.
Before, we can provide our pandas 5 kinds of bamboo in a day. Right now, we can just only provide 2. Before, you know, we can give the pandas 8 to 100 kilo bamboo. Right now, we can only give them 50.
As pandas munch their bamboo, he stresses the animals are not going hungry. This centre has been much luckier than the other main panda base, up the mountains in Wolong. It was destroyed. 5 staffers were killed, 1 panda died, and another is still missing. The government's just announced a $290 million plan to rebuild that centre. And 2 months on, much is still unknown about how the earthquake affected the 1,600 wild pandas, according to Sarah Bexell, Director of Conservation Education.
We do have a lot of worries about the wild population and, of course, all the other plants and animals in the region. Because as people saw, you know, on the television, you know, entire sides of mountains collapsed. And so, and this is prime habitat for giant pandas. And their habitat's already so extremely limited.
Inside her grassy enclosure, Jingjing the Olympic panda lumbers around, blithely ignoring her adoring public. The centre's habitat conservation programmes have all been halted. Like many others, the staffers are taking recovery one day at a time and still figuring out how to get by in this new post-quake world. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Chengdu, China.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.